The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 1999, we had an author coming through the region. He was visiting Cincinnati for an event, and he made a little detour and came out and saw us here in Yellow Springs and recorded an interview. His name was Dr. Leonard Schlain. Dr. Schlain had written a book called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, The Conflict Between Word and Image. And after this interview aired, I had so much feedback from listeners, and it continues to this day. Just the other day, someone came up to me and said, "I'll never forget that interview you did for The Alphabet Versus the Goddess." Well, that reminded me about it, and I went back and pulled out the interview. I hadn't listened to it since 1999 when I talked to Dr. Schlain, and he has since passed away. Let's listen now to Leonard Schlain. We call it The Best of the Book Nook.
Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And it's my pleasure to be joined in the studio today by Dr. Leonard Schlain, author of a number of books, and most recently, a book which just came out in a paperback. It's called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, The Conflict Between Word and Image. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What an intriguing book. You got the idea when you were on a tour out in the Mediterranean somewhere?
Right, right. Well, you know, my background is that I'm a surgeon. I'm an associate professor of surgery at UCSF in San Francisco. And many people ask me how a surgeon came to write a book about the goddess. And I've operated on many people's carotid arteries through brain, so I've long had a fascination with the differences between the right and left hemispheres. In addition to which, I wrote an earlier book entitled Art and Physics, in which I treated those two subjects as if they were languages, the art being the language of image and metaphor and physics being the language of numbers and equations. And to write that book, I became very enthralled with communications theories of the ideas of Marshall McLuhan. So when I went on this Mediterranean visit to archaeological sites about 8 years ago, our guide kept telling us the same story, and that was that whatever temple we stood before, whether it was Poseidon or Zeus or Apollo, she said, you know, originally these temples were consecrated to a goddess, and then unknown persons for unknown reasons reconsecrated into a god at a later date. And this happened with such regularity that by the time the trip was over and we're driving back to the airport, I was mulling over what I had seen. And, you know, there's just overwhelming archaeological and historical evidence that both men and women in the ancient world worshiped goddesses. Nobody disputes that. Women in these cultures were priestesses. They performed the major sacraments, and that's beyond doubt. And property generally passed through the mother's line. And then beginning about 5,000 years ago, the goddess started losing power, and the rise of a god started to supplant her. And then with the start of a Western culture, she disappeared. So the three religions of the West, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, do not feature a goddess. Women in these three religions were banned from conducting the slightest religious ceremony until very recently, and property began to pass exclusively through the male line. So I wanted to try to understand what happened. What event in culture could have been so immense and so pervasive as to literally change the sex of God? And the answer that I came up with after reviewing the multiple different theories that have been put forth by other peoples was that it was an inside job. I think that the thug who mugged the goddess was none other than the invention of literacy. Now, I know that that's a fairly provocative statement, but it's based on a knowledge of the right brain, left brain functions. And, you know, most of the and again, I'm only going to talk about right-handed people here because it'll make it a lot easier to prevent from getting in qualifiers. But in a right-handed person, man or woman, the modules necessary to nurture a small child, read body language, listen to the inflection in cries, read the facial expressions are located primarily in the right hemisphere of both men and women. And the modules necessary to locate, focus on, track, and kill another living thing are located primarily in the left hemisphere of both men and women. So in the book, I devote quite a bit of space to showing how the right hemisphere is the feminine side of both men and women, and the left hemisphere is the masculine side of both men and women. And the right hemisphere has this function where about 90% of the ability to recognize images and gestalts and faces are in your right hemisphere, and about 90% of your ability to recognize language and words and decipher them are in your left hemisphere. So when you read and write, you are using a distinctly different part of your brain than when you speak and listen.
That is if you're writing with your right hand.
Yes. So when you're listening to somebody, you're listening with your left hemisphere to the content of what they're saying. But your right hemisphere is checking them out. I mean, you want to see if they have alcohol on their breath or dandruff on their shoulders, whether they're tapping their fingertips on the tabletop. How many times you talk to somebody and they're agreeing with you and they're shaking their head from side to side, and you know that that's the more valid message. So when you're listening to somebody, both hemispheres are actively engaged. In order for me to speak, although Broca's area is generating these sentences, I need the cooperation of both sides of my lips, tongue, and vocal cords. In fact, if I've been to the dentist and I had Novocaine, I had trouble talking. We've all had that experience. So to speak and listen, you use both hemispheres. When you write with only one hand. Up until the invention of the typewriter, for 5,000 years, didn't matter whether you were a man or a woman, didn't matter whether you what language you were writing, didn't matter what implement you were holding, didn't matter what content you were writing. The hand that held the writing implement was the same hand that throws spears, swings swords, and pulls triggers. You can take your left hand and put it in your pocket while you're writing because you don't need it. So reading and writing lights up different areas of the brain on PET scans than listening and speaking. So what is the effect on culture? And this book is based on Marshall McLuhan's aphorism, "The medium is the message," meaning that how you perceive information is actually more important than the content of the information. And Sophocles once warned that nothing vast enters the life of mortals without a curse. I think all your listeners would agree with that. I mean, you know, if you won the lottery tomorrow, there wouldn't be something in those millions that wouldn't be so wonderful. Well, we would all agree that literacy was vast. I mean, what an incredible skill that humankind acquired. But what was its downside? What was the price that we paid for becoming literate? And I propose in the Alphabet versus the Goddess that cultures that become literate reinforce the left hemisphere and denigrate the right hemispheric way of knowing. So three things happen. The goddess disappears. Women's rights are sharply curtailed. And oddly enough, image information is abhorrent. So if you look in the most abstract form of writing is alphabet writing. So if you look at the three alphabet religions, the oldest book ever written in an alphabet is the Old Testament. And the most important part of this book are the Ten Commandments. The first commandment is the most revolutionary sentence ever transcribed. The first commandment states, "I am the Lord thy God, there is no other." Now, the Bible doesn't actually state that this deity is a man, but all of the nouns and adjectives that used to describe this deity are masculine. So it's safe to assume that this is a male deity. And if he's the only one, then what the first commandment basically states is that there was no woman involved in the creation of the universe. Now, up until the time this commandment was written, there were no people anywhere in the world that believed that the world could be created by a man alone. It was usually a woman alone or a man and a woman together, but never a man alone. So if I were to lay the Ten Commandments on the table here and ask your listeners to please come and order them in the sequence of their importance for their life today, I'd venture to say that everybody would put as number two, don't murder. But that's not number two. The second most important rule of righteous living is make no images. And it isn't just graven images. If you actually read the commandment, it says, "And thou shalt create no images of anything that flies in the air, creepeth on the ground, or is under the sea." In other words, no art. So let's step back for a moment. The first culture in the world to adopt an alphabetic sacred text is the first culture in the world to ban art. So my question would be, why is art more dangerous than murder? Now, at the height of the Roman Empire, when literacy was just taking off, and the library at Alexandria had 532,000 scrolls, and action novels and romance novels were making their first appearance, a new religion emerged as if from out of nowhere, based on the exceedingly wise and gentle words of the prophet Jesus. And what Jesus had to say was very feminine. He said, "Turn the other cheek, the meek shall inherit the earth, and the last shall be first." Women flocked to this new religion. They became priestesses. They baptized. They funded churches. They founded ministries. And they enjoyed these extraordinary prerogatives until a signal event. And that was the transcription of Jesus' words into the West's second alphabetic sacred text, known as the New Testament. And shortly thereafter, the women rapidly lost their power. First, they were told they could no longer baptize. Then they were told they had to sit in the back of the church. And by the 4th and 5th centuries, the religion had been taken over by the patriarchs, men who wrote long, imageless tomes that changed the original direction of Jesus' oral words from one of love and kindness to one that increasingly emphasized sin, guilt, suffering, and death. Now, it's fascinating that one of the first acts of the official Christian church in 313 AD in Rome was to destroy all the images, not just graven images. They destroyed every Greco-Roman image they could lay their hands on. And then it's very puzzling to me that, as best we know, Jesus wrote nothing down. I mean, isn't that odd? I mean, here he was, born into a culture that glorified the written word at a time in the empire when the emperor was having a love affair with the written word, and he told his disciples to memorize what he had to say. The Buddha wrote nothing down. Socrates wrote nothing down. Pythagoras wrote nothing down. What was it about these exceptional leaders that seemed to understand that the message changes when it gets written? The next thing that happened was absolutely remarkable. Rome collapsed, and with it, literacy got lost. And for 400 years, known as the Dark Ages, less than 1% of the population of Europe could read and write, and not a single king or nobleman could write. So you would think during a period of time of superstition and barbarity and the loss of governing laws that women's rights would have thoroughly suffocated. So when the stage of history gets reilluminated again in the 9th century, surprise, surprise, all over Europe.
Age of chivalry.
There's a male culture of troubadours singing the praises of womanhood. The chivalric code states that the highest aspiration of a man is to honor women, courtly love, women Christian mystics hailed by the church, abbesses leading monasteries all over Europe. But most importantly, the people of medieval Europe began to expend enormous sums of time, energy, and money erecting these fabulous cathedrals dedicated to Notre Dame.
Notre Dame.
So the image of Mary becomes ubiquitous. I mean, she leads every procession. She's in every shop wall, in every church. She doesn't say anything. There's no gospels according to Mary. And oddly enough, it would seem rather unusual that Mary should become such a prominent figure because the gospels barely mention her. And yet all over Europe, the cult of Mary is prominent. And, you can travel in a wide arc through Germany and France and Poland, and you'll find a church somewhere that has a
Black Madonna.
And why would people who are Caucasian and blonde and blue-eyed venerate a Black Madonna? The answer, I believe, is that all of the manifestations of the earth goddess were black. I mean, Artemis, Isis, Kali, Cybele. And the phenomenon of the Black Madonna begins to wane in the late Middle Ages, and then the Renaissance begins. And the Renaissance was this testosterone-driven male surge of creative energy that, to some extent, was fueled by this amazing invention that Gutenberg invented in 1454, the printing press. So literacy rates, which were in the low 20s%, skyrocketed with the invention of the printing press. And everybody rushed to learn this, to read this book that they'd all heard about, no one ever read before, called the New Testament. Now, the New Testament is indisputably about love and kindness and forgiveness. So you would think that people reading this book for the first time should behave towards each other in a very loving, kind, and forgiving fashion. But that's not what happened. The first thing that happened was the Protestant Reformation, led by an extremely patriarchal group of men who basically said, now that we can read this book by ourselves, we're going to make a few reforms in this religion. And high on our list of reforms is we want to get rid of Mary, we want to destroy all the images. And then what happened next is just so bizarre. I mean, in every country that was affected by the printing press, neighbors started to murder their neighbors, burn them at the stake. In England, Anglicans killed Presbyterians and Puritans killed Anglicans. In France, Huguenots, Catholics killed each other. In Germany, Calvinists and Lutherans killed each other. In Spain, the Catholics killed the Jews and the Moors. And if you're looking for this period of history in the history books, it's called the Age of Reason. I mean, this is the period when the most astonishing gains in science and art and music and literature and global exploration were occurring simultaneously. But, you know, Alfred North Whitehead once said that the major advances in civilization all but wreck the societies in which they occur. And nowhere is this more true than what happened in the Renaissance. Because the culture that was giving us Shakespeare and Galileo and Newton and Bach, the men had a psychosis so extreme that they thought their women were so dangerous they needed to be murdered. The witch hunts were the most virulent in the 15th and 16th century. They were the most virulent in those countries that had the steepest rising literacy rates, Germany, Switzerland, France, and England. Russia, which remained illiterate throughout this whole period, didn't have any witch hunts. If you were to go to a Hopi Indian or an Iroquois or a Kung Bushman and ask them, would you believe that there would be a culture in the world where the men would be murdering their wives, women? They would look at you in disbelief. It's never happened before. There's no culture in the world that murdered its wives, women, except Europe of the 15th and 16th century.
Just to give our readers some idea of the scope of this murder of women, you point out the Jesuit, I think it was in the area of Trier in the right. Wine country of Germany. There was one woman left.
When they were finished, in two villages, there was one woman left alive. Every grandmother, aunt, sister, cousin, niece, daughter, mother was killed. And it wasn't the peasants who were killing their women. It was the elite, the lawyers, the doctors, the priests, the noblemen. And there's never been, as I can see, an adequate explanation to explain why a culture should go so crazy that they would murder their women.
This is the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Today, I'm bringing you an interview that I recorded back in 1999 with Dr. Leonard Schlain. He was coming through the area for an event in Cincinnati for his book, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess. And we talked to him live in studio that day. What a fascinating man. He could talk and talk and talk. And we'll bring you another segment from that interview right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO as we revisit an interview I did back in 1999 with Dr. Leonard Schlain. He was a surgeon and also a writer, and he had written a very provocative book that had just come out in paperback called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, The Conflict Between Word and Image. Let's continue now with my 1999 interview with the late Dr. Leonard Schlain. When I prepare for this program, I never write down anything. Right. As far I read the book, the medium here, the alphabet, the way this is written in a book, is the medium that caused all this left brain stuff, right. But your message is what you've just said about right. about this very fact. When you wrote the book, did you try in some way to temper the way that you wrote it? I must point out, you write in a very, very fluid style. You have a wonderful way of writing.
Thank you. It pleases me a lot when people tell me that because you know, it's one thing to write a book about an idea, and then it's another thing to write it well. And I think it was John Kenneth Galbraith who once said that it's only after the ninth rewrite that things begin to sound spontaneous. You know? Yeah, but I can assure you this is after the 30th rewrite to try to get these sentences to just flow real smoothly and read well. But I think that it's interesting because I think this all changed in the 19th century with two things. One was the invention of photography, and the other one was the discovery of electromagnetism. And these two events changed the world because photography did for images what the printing press had done for the written word. And it made images cheap, easy, and available. I mean, by the end of the 19th century, there was virtually no one who had not sat for their photograph. If you were to ask anybody in the 200 years after the Protestant Reformation, your house is on fire and you can go in and retrieve only one personal object, what would it be? Everybody would say the family Bible. Within one generation of the invention of photography, the answer changed, and everybody knows what the answer is.
The family photo book.
Of course. Mm-hmm. And then electromagnetism and photography began to combine in this century to bring forth new technologies of image transfer, such as film. I mean, think of this. Film attendance surpassed church attendance within 10 years of its introduction. I mean, Charlie Chaplin was the most famous person in the world in the second decade of the 20th century. The most famous person in the world always encapsulates an age. It's usually a warrior or a king or a religious leader. Never been a clown. And a clown who didn't speak.
You know, and this just, is very right-brained.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. You know, poking fun of all that linear, sequential stuff of the left brain. So you have this phenomenon that Western education, since Western culture began, has been about reading, writing, and arithmetic. It's very linear. It's very sequential. And then in the 1950s, a new technology of information transfer came along called the television. And television completely discombobulated our society. I mean, television requires a different strategy to see television. I mean, for example, if you connect somebody's brain up to EEG leads and you give them a book to read, it doesn't matter what the content of the book is. They'll generate beta waves. Beta waves are what you generate when you're concentrating on a task. And we all know that to read a book, if you're in a noisy room, you have to concentrate. You'll get up and leave the room and go someplace quiet. Ask that person to look up from their book and start watching a television set. Any program, fake wrestling matches, cuddly koala bears, doesn't matter, sex and violence. The beta waves go away, and alpha and theta waves come up. Now, alpha and theta waves are what you generate when you meditate. I mean, who here hasn't had the experience of going home at the end of a hard day's work, taking that clicker in your hand, settling into that couch and going into a trance? In fact, when people are asked, what is the experience of watching television most like, the word most commonly used is hypnotizing. If you connect somebody up to a PET scanner, which is a sophisticated device to measure the metabolic activity in the brain, and you give them a book to read, any book, the left hemisphere is all lit up and the right hemisphere is relatively dark. Ask them to look up from their book and start watching a television set, and amazingly, the right hemisphere lights up and the left hemisphere goes dark. Now, in a culture that has its television sets on average 5 hours a day, how could that not have a profound impact on culture? We now live in a society that is awash in images. The next time you're with your friends, listen to what you're talking about. A film you saw, something you saw on television, something on the news, a sporting event on television. I mean, you know, Western culture has been moved primarily by long imageless tomes written by esteemed white males. I mean, Augustine, Plato, Aquinas, Marx, Hegel, Freud. These are the books that actually move the direction of Western culture.
And they were almost all misogynistic, weren't they?
Yeah, I challenge anybody to give me the name of a philosopher, a religious leader who wrote these long imageless tomes that wasn't a misogynist. I mean, you know, you're hard pressed to find any. But I would challenge all your listeners to name a single book written in the last 50 years since television that begins to compare to those older books that would have the power to change consciousness as much as the image of the atomic bomb in 1945. The image of the Earth beam back from space in 68. I mean, if I mention little girl running down the street on fire, I mean, your listeners don't need any more. They know what I'm talking about. Waco, Kosovo, Vietnam are all about images. And it doesn't matter what the editorials say. It doesn't matter what the books that are written about the subject. Images move public opinion now and change consciousness. And what's happened in this society that's been based on images now? Well, for one thing, women's rights have made an extraordinary comeback, haven't they? I mean, is it a coincidence that the suffragette movement just so happens to occur right after the invention of photography, but the first movement in 5,000 years dedicated to overthrowing patriarchy and misogyny happens to be the feminist movement that occurs in the 60s in the first generation of boys and girls raised on television? 40% of the Washington State Legislature are women. The entire Minnesota Supreme Court are women. The leader of this last space shot was a woman. Unthinkable 100 years ago.
In other words, you're hopeful for the future.
Very. I think that in the developed nations of the world that were literate, you know, it took us five centuries for literacy to seep through the fabric of our culture. And then it's taken us five decades for image information to do the same. I think in those countries, I'm not talking about the whole world now, but in those countries, feminine values are on the rise. I mean, if you look at the agendas of all the Western European nations and the United States, civil rights, human rights, welfare, health care, child care, care for the environment. I mean, men's attitude towards nature has always been to conquer and subdue it. And men are leading the whole environmental movement, which is to honor and protect the earth. And, you know, you have men that are chaining themselves to trees saying, this tree is so beautiful, you can't cut it down. I mean, can you imagine a Greek or a Roman chaining himself to a tree? Well, it wouldn't have happened. So at the same time, the United States Army recognizes Wicca as an official religion so that if a young soldier wants to worship the goddess, he can. So the goddess is making this tremendous comeback in our society. Women are priestesses again. I mean, they're rabbis, they're ministers, and I think it's only a matter of time before the Catholic Church caves in and lets women be priests. And, of course, men are embracing feminine values too. I mean, I think that men are better fathers to their children today and better husbands to their wives than they were 100 years ago. And this is not happening everywhere at once. I mean, like, for example, the Taliban in Afghanistan, who are just recently literate, are recapitulating the witch hunts of the 15th and 16th century in Europe when the Europeans became literate. What are they doing? They're destroying images, confiscating TV sets, taking away women's rights, and doing the same things that the men did in post-Gutenberg. But I'm hopeful because I think that the fundamentalism is on the wane because electromagnetic energy cannot be stopped. You cannot keep it out. Whenever a man is trying to take away rights from a woman, you can almost count on the fact that he'll have a book in his hand that he's waving and pointing to and saying that in this book says, you know, the truth. And I think that we're in a period of history now where our brains are coming into balance. Now, I don't want anyone to think that I'm saying that you shouldn't read, because reading is a very, very valuable skill. But I think that Western culture has been stuck for too long in a beta, yang, macho, masculine mode that has been it served us very well in making tremendous advances in science and in other fields. But it's also been the most strife-ridden, murderous culture. I mean, there's been no other people in the world ever that murdered each other over religion. I mean, in China, you could be a Taoist, a Confucianist, and a Buddhist all at the same time. It's not a problem. In ancient Greece, there were three gods of war. There was Ares, Apollo, and Athena. And there's not a single recorded case of the followers of Ares marching down to the temple of Apollo and burning those people at the stake. And then along comes Western culture, and lo and behold, we have heretic houndings and inquisitions and crusades and pogroms and holocausts. And people start to murder other people for the slightest doctrinal dispute in religion. And if you look at what is the common denominator of these religious wars, it's alphabetic sacred texts. If you believe in an alphabetic sacred text, whether it's the Quran, the Old Testament, or the New Testament.
Or the Communist Manifesto.
Or the Communist Manifesto, because I say in the book that it was really a religious book. I mean, when you look at the way the communists behaved, they behaved just like the religious zealots of the post-Reformation periods. I mean, there was no distinction. You know, that if you become that ideological about a book that you're willing to kill somebody for it, I mean, the written word has a profound impact on our brains.
You're listening to The Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today we are going back to 1999 for an interview I did in studio with Dr. Leonard Schlain. He was going to be in Cincinnati that night, and he came out to see us here in Yellow Springs and talked about a book which had just come out in paperback called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, The Conflict Between Word and Image. And he had some controversial ideas, nevertheless, fascinating thoughts about various subjects. And we'll bring you the final segment of our interview with Dr. Schlein from 1999 right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and today we are going back into our archive for an interview I did back in 1999 with Dr. Leonard Schlein. He came out to see us here in Yellow Springs and spoke to us about his book, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, The Conflict Between Word and Image.
There is so much in this book. You cover so much ground, and you do it so succinctly and pithily to cover all this ground. There are so many different things I'd like to ask you about, but a couple of things that I'd like to bring up right now. When you talk about the electromagnetic field and the impact that made and electricity itself, mm-hmm. you use the fact that a lot of the things we use to describe it, like the word field, a lot of the terminology that we use for electricity has feminine connections.
Absolutely.
And then you also point out the Romance languages in Europe and how if you look at the genders of different nouns, the feminine gender nouns tend to have sort of negative connotations.
Right.
Could you elucidate a little bit on those?
Well, I point out in the book that I think that several factors are moving the world towards a more egalitarian position, and one of them is the fact that English is becoming the world language due to the American century, I believe. And the fact that England had such a large empire. And English is a fortuitous choice for a world language because all of the other European languages, almost without exception, all of the nouns have values and the values are sexual. So a child about age 2 or 3 has to learn that this noun is a masculine noun and this noun is a feminine noun. And you use a certain rustic barnyard sense to figure out most of the gender of the nouns, whether sword and scabbard or gun and holster. But then when you start getting into the more abstract nouns, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, like, why is malady in French, which means sickness, feminine? And why is mind in German masculine and foible feminine? And why is indecision in Spanish feminine? And why is valor masculine? Why is disability in Italian feminine and honor masculine? Now, this doesn't hold across the spectrum, of course, but for sure, if you made a list of all the negative connotation nouns and positive connotation nouns, you'd find that the feminine ones are more negative. So what effect does that have on a little child, a little boy learning the language? Gee, all the good nouns are the guy nouns and all the bad nouns are the girl nouns. And what effect does that have on a girl's self-esteem? So I think that's one factor. The other factor is that at the end of the 19th century, there was a group that formed this Esperanto for trying to get a world language, and they tried to meld together a bunch of European languages. But Esperanto never caught on because we've already developed a universal language. It's called icons. You know, the word logos originally meant the word. We dropped the S, and now it means the icon. And if you're looking for the men's room, don't look for MEN anymore. It's a little picture of a man. If you're driving down the road, going into a hospital or an airport, I mean, man, we are reinventing hieroglyphics. We have these most incredibly complicated icons that stand for fairly sophisticated concepts. And that's happening to some extent because I think that the other revolution that's happening is the personal computer and the internet. And I believe these are very feminizing influences. I mean, you know, for 5,000 years, the only way you could write was to write with one hand, your dominant hand. And then the typewriter comes along in the late 19th century. You have to type with both hands. It's a little bit like playing a musical instrument. Each hand is doing something different. But the problem was only women learned how to type. They were all the secretaries. So the computer comes along in the 1970s, and all the men rushed to learn a skill that their grandfathers considered was for sissies, called typing. So what is the effect of millions of men's left hands connected to millions of men's right brains tapping out one half of every written message? And furthermore, when you're writing, you have to look at the page. If you happen to look away while you're writing will go all over the page. So the manufacturer gives you blind paper to stay between the lane markers. The next time someone's operating a computer, watch them. They're looking at a screen. And in their right hand, they're moving a mouse in a random pattern over a mouse pad. Now, your left brain doesn't know how to do that. That's a spatial activity that's best performed by your right brain. So in order to operate a computer, you have to the left hemisphere has to tiptoe across the corpus callosum and go psst to the right hemisphere and say, come on over here and show me how to operate this thing. So the process of using a computer is a very feminine process. I mean, what effect does it have for an 8-year-old boy to log on to the World Wide Web or the Internet? I mean, the last time I looked, every ancient deity associated with webs and nets was a goddess.
Here you are doing all this surgery. You're an extremely busy physician. You must have just an incredible passion for writing books. For you to have put the effort into writing a book like this, how do you find the time?
Well, I say in the preface that, you know, when I grab hold of an idea, it's a little bit like a dog wearing a bone, you know. I mean, once the idea occurred to me and I said, you know, this just feels right. And the more I started to investigate it and the more research I did into it, it became like an obsession. I mean, that's what, if you're going to write any book, you know, Franz Kafka once said that a book should be like a pickaxe to break the frozen sea within us. I mean, if a book doesn't change the way you think about things, there's no point in writing it, is the way he felt, and that's the way I feel. So like my earlier book, Art and Physics, Parallel Visions in Space, Time, and Light, proposed that the visionary artist had anticipated all the great ideas in physics using image and metaphor prior to their explication in numbers and formulae. So that book, too, was, you know, became a passion. I mean, it also was, like this one, a national bestseller. When I wrote a book about art and physics, and then I thought, well, I ought to be able to write a book about women and religion. And there were so many questions about our culture that seemed so inexplicable to me, so many people's behavior that I couldn't understand. And somehow or other, and I know history is multifactorial. It's very difficult to say, oh, this is the one factor that caused everything. And I want to make it clear that, you know, every morning when I get up in the morning, the stars disappear. And then the next thing that happens is the sun comes up. It's happened every morning of my life. I cannot say, therefore, that the sun's appearance is because the stars disappeared. That's causality. My book is more about correlation. I'm kind of depend on what the archaeologists call the theory of competitive plausibility. You don't have all the facts, but you lay out all these correlations and you let the reader choose. He says, does this sound right? Does this ring true? And I have to tell you, I put my email address on the back of the book, and I'm just receiving a ton of emails from people from all over the world now who are very affected by this book. They say that this has served for them. It's opened up a whole different way of looking at so many things that seemed inscrutable before, sort of like, oh, yeah, that fits, you know.
And your website is alphabetvsgoddess.com.
Right, and I also have an email, which is L. Schlain, and that's S-H-L-A-I-N at AOL.com. And I enjoy getting these, you know, when you're an author and you write a book, you know, you just send the book out into the void and, you know, you're kind of curious, well, gee, what do people think of it? And, you know, I must admit, I mean, I'm being invited by church groups all over the country to speak.
What kind of churches?
Well, I just received an email from someone who tells me that the National Catholic Reporter is recommending this book as a must read in their winter edition. They're saying you may not agree with this, but it's certainly provocative and you have to look at it. And the Christ Church in Houston invited me to come down to speak recently. And this woman came up to me in a bookstore and she said, you know, I belong to a Lutheran Bible study group, and our pastor told us, put away your Bibles. We're going to read this book for a while because it's got some interesting ideas about religion in it. So I must admit that I'm sort of blown away by that kind of response.
That's really amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's not all positive. I mean, there's certainly some people that have taken me to task.
Well, I'd like to know what points in the book have turned out to be the most controversial.
Well, I must admit that, you know, when you write a book, you have this knowledge. And you're constantly having to decide, you know this. Does the reader know this? I mean, how many times do you have to pound the reader over the head and reiterate it to say, remember what I said? So there's this fine balance that you're trying to always think to yourself, is this something that everybody knows or is this something that only I know or that I'm aware of in a few other people? So like one thing when I said that, a number of people have criticized me and say, oh, you're not going to use that old pop psychology, right brain, left brain thing. Oh, the brain is much more complicated than that. Everybody knows that. And I think to myself, my goodness, they've never taken care of a stroke victim, have they? You know, as a surgeon taking care of stroke victims, I'm here to tell you that if you're right-handed and you have a stroke in your left hemisphere, you lose certain faculties that you don't lose if you have a stroke in your right hemisphere. That's indisputable. Nobody doubts that. And there's just a wealth of work indicating that there are distinct areas of the brain that perform different functions. So I'm kind of taken aback when people attack me by saying, oh, that's that 60s new age pop psychology stuff, you know. Then there are a number of academicians who resent that a non-specialist has wandered into their field of expertise and wandered out again, tracked through some mud, and I've learned now that if I'm ever at any event, I speak at a lot of college campuses, and if I'm ever at any event and somebody stands up and takes the microphone and begins their question with a statement that I am a neuroscientist, I am an archaeologist, I am an anthropologist, then I know that what's coming next is, you know, a statement about, you know, how could you think that you could understand my field? But, you know, there's a lot of information that a lot of people would like to think that you have to only talk about it in jargonese and it's not accessible to the public. And what I try to do is just take some fairly complicated technical things and reduce it into everyday language to make it readable.
I must say you do a magnificent job of bringing the reader a lot of information on so many different historical periods, and yet you do it in a way that I think is very accessible to most readers and moves along very, very quickly, and the transitions really make sense. You really came up with some great titles for your different chapters. I mean, it just moves right along.
Yeah, I mean, I'm covering 3 million years. You know, I discuss a lot of anthropology in the book and how we came about. Well, I mean, why do we have a split brain? I mean, every vertebrate from a fish forward has a bilobed brain. I mean, and if you look at those brains of fish and amphibians and dogs, and they each lobe looks exactly like the other lobe, but they're mirror images. They do exactly the same thing. And it's only in human and a few other species that we have this thing called hemispheric lateralization, where we have this distinct functional differences between the two hemispheres. And I think that the reason this developed is that, you know, there's 134 different kinds of primates, and 133 of them are vegetarians. Only one of them will sit down and eat the meal tonight of a flesh of another animal. I mean, chimps and baboons eat about 2% of their diet as meat. But the only truly predatory primate is a human being. So you have to go back about 3 million years at the edge of the savanna and say, how did this creature with no claws and no sharp teeth and no great speed and no great strength enter the predatory sweepstakes and compete against lions and tigers and sharks and eagles and win? I mean, my God, we've won the gold medal. I mean, in another generation, we'll make all these other predators extinct. Well, you know, we were on bipedal, but that wasn't the key. The key was that we were very intelligent. We kept getting smarter and smarter and smarter.
And we had thumbs.
And we could throw stones. Our hands were free. But that in itself would not have made us so successful. What was made us so successful was we kept getting very smart until a catastrophe occurred. The brains of our babies became so large that they got stuck in the mother's birth canal. And when that happened, that leads to the paradoxical fact that the single greatest cause of death among human females until very recently was birth. So the limit of human intelligence was set by the diameter of a female's pelvis. So nature tried to increase the diameter of the pelvis to allow a bigger brain baby through. So the woman began to walk with a distinct swivel to her hips. But you can only do that for so long, because pretty soon she starts to waddle. And then she would be unable to walk, support the weight of her upright above her. So the limit of human intelligence is the diameter of a woman's pelvis. So nature solves the problem by delivering this immature baby, almost devoid of instincts, hasn't got a clue as to how to behave in the world. And the missing pieces of the baby's brain are ladled in after the baby is safely on the other side of the mother's pelvic ring of bone. They're called culture. And the agent that evolution designed to do this for was language. Language is such a complicated computer program. My God, it requires such vast tracts of real estate in the brain that what happened is that the left hemisphere in right-handed people became the language lobe. I mean, 90% of your language centers are located in that lobe if you're right-handed and if you're a male. It's not so much in homosexual men. It's not so much in women. It's not so much in left-handed people. But it's pretty dichotomous. And then the right hemisphere retains this capacity to see images and gestalts and read faces and body language and pick up all these nonverbal clues. So we have this pretty distinct differences between our hemispheres. So that was one thing that I was kind of surprised about. And I think the other thing was that when I assigned the right hemisphere as the feminine lobe and the left hemisphere as the masculine lobe, I got a lot of heat on that too. But, you know, I thought about it later, and what I should have put in the book, which I didn't, is that in every single culture in the world, the majority of people are right-handed, over about 90%. In every one of those cultures, they refer to the left hand, controlled by the right brain, with terms that men use to refer to women. In fact, in many languages in the world, the left hand is called the feminine hand, and the right hand is called the masculine hand. If you think of all those negative connotations, such as La Sinestra, which means left and sinister, and gauche in French, which also means clumsy, and the word awkward in English comes from the Old English awk, which means left. So you have all these kind of derogatory terms that men have referred to women, referring to the side of the body that's controlled by the right brain. So, and then, of course, all those good positive words like righteous and right standing and upright and rectitude are all referred to the right side of the body, which is controlled by the left brain, which is very masculine. So it's too bad. If I had a chance to write the book over, I would have put in about 8 or 9 more pages to back up my statement that the right hemisphere is feminine, and of course, this is not black and white. You know, there's many, many nuances in the brain, but I make these distinctions in mainly overlapping bell-shaped curves.
My guest is Dr. Leonard Schlain. His book is The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, The Conflict Between Word and Image. It's just come out in a paperback, and it's a very intriguing book. I could talk to him about it for hours. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, but do remember, when you hear in-depth interviews that really talk about books, they're always on the left end of the dial on public radio. Just remember that, folks, as we're talking about left and right here. Well, it's really a pleasure to meet you, and thanks for the book.
And thank you.
This has been the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 1999 interview with Dr. Leonard Schlain. And Dr. Schlain died in 2009, and I looked at his website last night and saw this note from his children that had been posted. And they wrote that on Friday, May 7th, Ina, his wife, and our stepmother called all three siblings and his two best friends to his bedside. She said he had something he wanted to tell all of us. We gathered around him, but this time he couldn't speak. Still, we could see the thoughts dancing in his eyes. He looked frustrated at not being able to find words, but then he started to look amazed. He kept saying, "Wow." Then he started to slip away. He died Monday, May 11th at 5:40 a.m. At the time, Dr. Schlain had been working on a book called Leonardo's Brain, and he stayed alive to finish that book. Leonardo's Brain, the final book from Dr. Leonard Schlain, is not only one of his grand intellectual journeys akin to his books Art and Physics, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, and Sex, Time, and Power, but as his children write, it also kept him alive. He loved more than anything to share. As his children, we are honored to share this book with you. Dr. Leonard Schlain, what a mind he had, and what a great talker. He could really, really delve into a subject. For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for listening.